All right, and now it is my pleasure to introduce someone that I have known and loved and respected and admired for some 20 years, my friend Jay.
Evening, everyone. My name's Jay Stinnett, and I'm an alcoholic. And God's doing for me today what I couldn't do for myself, because it's 7:40 on a Wednesday evening, and I haven't had anything to drink all day today, which for an alcoholic of my variety is really a remarkable thing. For those of you who are new, I'd like to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous and let you know that my purpose here this evening is to comfort the afflicted and to afflict the comfortable. Nobody speaks for Alcoholics Anonymous, but tonight I'll sound like it on a few occasions, and the more I sound like I'm talking on behalf of Alcoholics Anonymous, those are the opinion sections, okay? I bring you greetings from my fabulous wife, Adele. I came to you on the second day of May in 1979, and although I've found it necessary in a lot of occasions, I haven't taken the front drink, smoked any of that non-habit-forming marijuana, sniffed any glue, or done any of those other things that I found to be so consoling. So if you're new with us tonight, I want to tell you that relapse does not have to be part of recovery. We all have our stories, and it may be part of your story, but it doesn't have to. You don't have to drink alcohol or use any of that other stuff ever again if you don't want to. So I bring you greetings from my fabulous wife, Adele. She's sober 15 years. Happy birthday, Megan. Let's call the whole thing off. I just celebrated my 26th a couple days ago, so that was grand fun. Alice Cooper sobriety, 18. I just don't know what to say. I love it. I'm sorry, ancient history. I bring you greetings from my sister Regina, who is 18 years sober. Her husband Greg is 20 years sober. I also bring you greetings from my mother, who's been in the Al-Anon family groups for 21 years. So if any of you are members of the Al-Anon family groups, I'd like to thank you for what it is that you've done for our family. And all these people are sober from their first meeting of AA. So, you know, if you're new, welcome. Fight's over. And this thing works really, really well. I was born in El Segundo, California, which, if you need a reason to drink, is as good as any. Toxicity is kind of a way of life there. You know, on one side you got the airport, on the other side you got the Northrop contractor, and you know, the south side is the Chevron oil refinery from whence the city got its name, and then on the little patch of beach between El Segundo and the Pacific Ocean is the waste treatment plant for the entire county of Los Angeles. So you just want to get right with your environment. You know, now, as I've told you from the recovery side, you know that alcoholism doesn't run in my family. It gallops. But I also have, and for those of you who are new, you know, folks like Jeff and I and the members that have been around here a while, you know, you may get a little irritated with us over time, because we may be saying you're not going to enough meetings, you don't have a sponsor, you know, these kinds of things. And the reason is that we have experience with alcoholism. We know that it kills and how it kills and how it grinds everything away that makes a human being and leaves them nothing but a self-consumed animal. And I watched my stepmother die from cirrhosis of the liver. I watched my father die from complications of alcoholism. I've got a sister who's living on the streets right now. She doesn't have a drug or alcohol problem. She just dates poorly and marries worse. So there's a lot of different ways that we can find to destroy ourselves. I didn't know I was alcoholic. But I feel that I'm a poster child for this genetic component of this disease I have, this alcoholism. I was the short guy in school. You guys all remember the short guy. I can't throw the ball as far. I can't run as fast. But I found out something when I was 12 years old that I could do better than kids that are bigger and stronger than I am. And that's metabolized beverage alcohol. This obviously is a gift from God. Now, I don't understand that what I am is I'm part of a different type of person. About 10% of the population, when you put alcohol into us, it does things to us and with us and for us that 90% of the population it doesn't do. And I don't realize this. All I know is that when I start to drink, life gets interesting. When I start to drink, I can use my whole lung capacity. And the knots that have been inside me just kind of wind out. And my dad looked good and moved fast, and so I tried to do the same. And so I started. Are there any morning drinkers here? Yeah, okay. Now, there's a couple different kinds of people you meet in AA. There's the has-beens. These are the people that have tremendous careers, families, position. And then over time, they start to drink. And then they start drinking in the afternoons. And then they end up drinking wine in the alley in the morning. Those are the has-beens. Then there's folks like me, the never-wases. We start out drinking wine in the alley in the morning. And we never go anywhere. So I knew that only lames do it on the natch. The last thing I want to do is be a lame. So by the time I'm 13 years old on my way to school, I know how to get prepared to be educated. I know the purpose of nutrition break, and it's got absolutely nothing to do with food. And then you really get the job done after school, and that's how I lived my life. Now, one of the things about being the short guy is it's difficult to get enough to drink. So there were other things that were available, and so I start to do these things. And again, see, I don't realize that I'm alcoholic, that I have a physical allergy. And the way that this allergy manifests itself is, number one, in an obsession of the mind. And the way that the obsession of the mind goes is, it goes, we're not drinking. We're not having any fun. And we really deserve to have some fun. And we should be drinking right now. Look at all these lames here. Let's get the hell out of here now. And it's like the middle of third period in ninth grade. And see, I don't realize that that's alcoholism. I think that when my mind says it's time to go, that I've got to go. So I've got this mind, and then this allergy of the body, the way that it manifests itself, that once I start to drink, the most eloquent way that I've ever heard it put is a Chinese proverb where the man takes a drink, and then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. And does that happen every time? No, but with me, it happens frequently. And I don't realize what that is. So by the time I'm 16 years old, I'm sticking needles in my arm. I'm doing all these different things. In fact, you know, if you don't know whether you're alcoholic or not, whether you're part of this 10%, take a look at what you do for recreation and then see how that manifests with 90% of the population. Example, by the time I'm 16 years old, my idea of a good time is to get a rack of Reds, 3 high-powered sedative hypnotics, Seconal, wash it down with a quart of Spinata wine. Okay? In 90% of the population, what happens is a thing called synergistic effect. The alcohol and the sedative hypnotic mix together, the brain starts to shut down. In many cases, people forget how to breathe. They throw up and they choke on their vomit. They call it Hollywood death. Okay? With me, I'm looking for car keys and to make short-term romantic commitments. I'm alcoholic, but I don't know it. I don't know it. Another thing that manifests in this is blackout. Okay? For you folks that are new, this is our way of talking about operating this vehicle, this earth suit, with absolutely no conscious recollection of where one's been and what one's doing. If you've woken up with a life form with which you were unfamiliar when you left the house, you may want to take a look at how this beverage alcohol affects your body. Okay? Now, the other part of this disease that I have, this alcoholism, is this phenomenon of craving I talked about with the proverb. And I didn't know about it when I came to you. I mean, did you ever have this happen to you? They look at you and they go, "No drinking at work." Test case here, I know. And you go, "Oh, okay. I won't have anything to drink at work. And no coming to work drinking either. No problem." Now, I don't know about you guys, but I hate to pay retail. So as employment in the days, I preferred to tend bar, preferably during the day, so I was available for the evening's activities. So you get off work, you go have a couple of pops, right? And you get home early. Everybody in this room knows what getting home early is, right? If I'm through the door before last call, I'm home early, right? And I get home early, and then I go to bed, and I kind of fall down, and I had good sponsorship in those days. I was taught to keep a cold beer next to the bed so that when I came to around 3:15, I could drink it down and go down for another couple hours. So I wake up about 5:30, and I start to get ready for work. And I got to get ready for work by having a few beers. And then I got to get on the bus. You know, I got to have a few beers to get on the bus. And you guys all know why I'm taking public transportation, right? It's because of all the driving under the influences and the lawyer fees and the, you know, I can't pay the insurance and all that stuff. So I'm a fan of public transportation. And I'm taking the bus where? I'm taking the bus downtown because the only kind of bar that's going to hire a guy like me is downtown. And I get down there, and on the way to work, I stop in at another spot to have a couple more beers. And I walk into work, and the guy says, "What the hell is wrong with you? Didn't we just talk about this yesterday? You weren't going to have anything to drink before you came to work, and you're drunk again. What the hell is the matter with you?" And I can look them dead in the eye and tell them, "I have not had anything to drink." Because I know, as you know, that beer is not drinking. It's a food, right? At the very least, it's a beverage. You know, the people who think that beer is drinking, those are the same people that will tell you smoking pot is what is doing drugs. No, it's what you do in between doing drugs, right? So anyway, and I look at him and I go, "I haven't been drinking." And they say, "Get the money, get the hell out of here." See, my alcoholic life is the only one that I know. It just makes sense to me. Did you ever have this happen to you? Again, back to this thing of phenomenon of craving. You know, the other malady that I have is this soul sickness. And the soul sickness comes from the fact that I will violate the trust of anybody who puts any in me. I will violate any social contract with you. I will always have at some point, no matter what it is that we got to do, I got to go and drink. Is it every time? No. But it's enough. Like, did you ever have this happen? You come home and they've changed the locks. And they've got the alcoholic luggage waiting for you. Two hefty bags with all your belongings. And so you make a little noise, you know, get the neighbors up. And then they finally come down and they open the door and they go, and they're crying. "Where have you been?" And I get real literal when I'm drinking. I don't know about you guys, but I say, "Well, I've been busy. I said I'd be home at 4 o'clock. That was Tuesday afternoon. This is Thursday morning. Where the hell have you been?" And I don't know what to say. They say, "Get the hell out of here. You don't love me. You'd rather drink with your friends than come home to me. I love you. Well, then why couldn't you come home? I have no way until I got to you, to Alcoholics Anonymous, to find out that once I take the front drink, I cannot determine where it is that I'm going to end up, that I've lost the power of choice. And I don't know what it is. You know, I got off work. We went out. We had a few pops. We drank through the evening. Went to an after-hours bar, drank until the morning, till we could go to a bar and get a real drink. You know, drank until about noon, got some Peruvian marching powder, drank all through the evening, and it's time to come home. I violated the trust of anybody that ever put any into it. So I don't know what the problem is. I think what I am is I'm a bad guy, and I'm getting what I deserve. So I ran into a patch of bad luck. I got 3 driving under the influences in a 9-week period, and afterwards we were discussing my plight with my father. We were doing it over a vodka rocks at the Marriott in Santa Clara, and he said, "Do you think you have the disease?" And the still small voice inside of me said, "Pay really close attention. You might get the lawyer paid for it." And he said, I made arrangements. You can stay with my mom down in El Segundo. I want you to call this guy." So I go down to my grandmother's house, and I call this guy up, and he says, "Meet me at the Howard Johnson's in Culver City tomorrow morning, 7:30. Don't have anything to drink at all." How did he know? So I go and I meet this guy. And he starts talking about himself and talking about himself and talking about himself. And he had these problems. And he met Alcoholics Anonymous. And then life became wonderful, and talking about himself and talking about himself. And it's been about half an hour, and I haven't had anything to drink. And I'm starting to get the zups, and I need to get out of there quick. So I figure what I'll do is the guy's not closing me, so I'll just prompt him. I say, "Look, do I need psychiatric treatment? Do I require hospitalization? Maybe what I need is a treatment program. Maybe I need religion." And he looks at me and he said, "Well, Trick," he said, "if you can get your hands on $3,000, go out and drink that money up. And when you're done, call Alcoholics Anonymous. They do it for fun and for free." Now, I don't know about you guys, but I'd had a lot of people that were trying to help me in those days, and nobody had ever said what it is you do if you come across $3,000. Of course you'd, you know, drink it up, and then you plan your next move, right? But I went home to my grandmother's house, and I poured myself a water glass full of Davies County old-fashioned bourbon with 3 ice cubes, and that was on the second day of May in 1979. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ended up at a noon meeting at the old Manhattan Beach Club and walked into the clubhouse, and the woman behind the coffee bar said, "You, upstairs." And I walked up these 12 steps into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And everybody started talking at me. And I couldn't understand why they were talking at me. But when my hair's long, I kind of look like the Sphinx. And I haven't had enough to drink really that day, and so I got the zups going. And when I came to you, my wardrobe was, I had a good t-shirt, a bad t-shirt, a pair of Levi's, and a pair of bowling shoes. I'd been living in my Pinto. I wasn't homeless. It was just my outdoorsman phase. And the third guy who talked was a guy by the name of Butcher Joe, and you can always tell Butcher Joe. And Joe talked about when the family walked out on him and how he's crying the big crocodile tears, and inside he's going, "Yes! Now we can drink and nobody's going to get in our way." And I understood that. And he talked about knowing just how deeply to cut his hand so that they'd have to take him to the little emergency room to get a stitch or two and that he could get a drink along the way. And I understood that. See, I know when things are tough, how to go into a bar and set a game up with the bartender where I will eat glass. I'm a real geek, not one of these computer folks. I'm a circus performer. I will chew glass in order to get enough money to drink. I need to drink. I've got to have it. And he told me that I never had to take another drink ever again. And they made the most outlandish promise to me. They said, "This is the last time that you ever have to withdraw." What? And so I bought the whole package right there. I mean, I saw the 12 steps. That's not the language that I would have put it in. But the first step is obviously it's awful, and I can't make it stop. After the meeting, a couple gentlemen took me down to the beach to explain Alcoholics Anonymous to me. They said, "We don't drink, we don't use, we don't go with girls who do." They said, "If you be alcoholic, we don't use no dope." I was horrified. But they explained to me that, you know how if you smoke a little of that non-habit-forming marijuana, sooner or later you got to cut cotton mouth, right? And you guys all know how to do that. You know, you drink a couple of beers, right? And that's not drinking. That's just cutting cotton mouth, right? And if you do the Peruvian marching powder, you need a little of that double Bombay on the rocks with a twist, just to take the edge off. And they said that was drinking. I didn't know. And they even told me that if I was checking myself out spiritually, you know, with a little LSD, that, you know, you need about a gallon of Red Mountain just to settle through the experience, right? And they told me that was drinking. They told me I couldn't use NyQuil. Because I don't know about you guys, but I've been stuck in places like Idaho on a Sunday when they didn't sell any booze. And, oh, thank heaven for 7-Eleven. Come on, honey, we'll just pretend it's cream de menthe on the rocks. Yeah. They said that I couldn't use alcohol in any form whatsoever. In the doctor's opinion of this book, it talks about O'Doul's and all those other alcohol-containing beverages that only those who are selling it to you call non-alcoholic. Why is that? Oh, it's the percentage. It's just the same as the amount of orange in an orange. Bullshit. Oh, excuse me. In the doctor's opinion, Silkworth says that the only remedy that we have is abstinence from alcohol in any form whatsoever. And when you've been to the funerals and you look at the wives and you look at the mothers and you look at the children and they say, "I thought they were with you. I thought they were okay." Well, no, they really weren't with us. They weren't willing to do the things that we found necessary to do. So, anyway, I almost drank Friday night. I came in on a Wednesday noon. I almost drank Friday night. I ended up back at the Alano Club. Finally got a copy of the book. I'd been too cool to get a copy of. Guy sent me home. He said, "Start at the beginning." I was surrounded by caring nurturers in those days. They said things to me like, "Nobody ever died from lack of sleep trick." You know, and remember, this is the last time you ever have to shake it out. So I start reading the book, and I got fascinated. When Silkworth talks about the sense of ease and comfort that comes from having a few drinks, I got hooked. Because I remember what it was like when the third one had stayed down and you could light your own cigarette. It's a wonderful thing. And I kept reading, and I got into Bill's story, and I wasn't interested in World War I. Or the stock market crash. I mean, give me something contemporary. Give me something disco. Do you realize how awful it was getting sober wearing that stuff? There were meetings in this part of town that you had to wear 3 gold chains just to get into. It was awful. But I kept reading. And I got to the part in We Agnostics at the end. There's the story of the preacher's son. And the preacher's son tells this story about, you know, thinking about everybody that he knew that seemed to be happy and have some handle on life. And they all believed in God. And it says, "Who are you to say that there is no God?" And he talks about getting down on his knees and saying a prayer. And he has a big white light experience. Well, I got down on my knees and I said my prayer. And my prayer was, I don't know, from Jesus or Buddha, the Talmud, the Torah, the Upanishads, just please get me the top. I said, "I will do whatever these dried up old geeks say to do. Please help me not to drink." And I believe at that moment that I'd worked the first 3 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a meeting at noon that day. There was a, I was there early at 10 o'clock, withdrawing on the Naga hide couch at the Alano Club. Had the bad T-shirt on, so I was stuck to the couch. There was a woman there. She had a black dress on, a bun in her hair, correct shoes. "Oh, young man, you're new, aren't you? How can you tell?" She said, "I didn't tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous, four words." "Really? What are they?" "Find God or die." "No, not that. Not that." 26 years later, I can tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous in four words. Find God or die. But the wonderful thing is that we're in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and if you don't want a spiritual solution to your problem, that's fine. But this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what we have to offer. And the marvelous thing is that we will never presume to tell you what kind of God you have to find. All that we insist is that you find a relationship with a power that's greater than yourself. And what we have to offer you is we have 12 spiritual exercises, which when you do them, will produce a result. But it has to be done, not agreed with. Not agreed with. There are tens of thousands of people in meetings tonight. But how many of them have done AA? This is not something to agree with. The four agreements are a different program, and it may work for alcoholism or drug addiction, but not this. Okay? So anyway, I got a sponsor at that meeting. And I started reading the book. I did my first inventory when I was 22 days sober. Was it a fearless and thorough moral inventory using all four columns? No! My sponsor gave me the four-step prayer. "God, I don't know what I'm doing. Help me, please." He said, "Get really jacked up on coffee. Look at the door." He said, "Think of where you lived, where you worked, your family, places that you lived, your friends, life forms that you woke up with, people that you stole from, schools that you went through. And if those people were to walk through that door and your stomach could go like this, you get three sentences to write down why. Nobody's life is that interesting." And I did it. And he came over the next day and I read it to him. We said the silly prayers. I burned it. And then I got out into working my ninth step. I had 24 days sober. Okay? "Have you done other inventories?" "Of course. Of course." But I was a fully vested member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was doing the work. You know, and it's not a thing of, you know, well, were they ready for us or ready for the steps? No, were we ready for them? This is not brain surgery. This is not rocket science. You know, people will say, "Oh, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work." Really? Really? When somebody says that to you, challenge them. Say, "Excuse me, did you admit that you were powerless? Did you come to believe that something would help you? Did you ask for the help? Did you write the stuff down? Did you share it with somebody else? And did you go back and pay back the money? Did you look the people in the eye whose trust you violated and ask them, what can I do to make this better?" This is Alcoholics Anonymous, not this wonderful social stuff that we do, which is all wonderful and supportive, and it's a way that we get to meet people. But it's about working the steps, about doing the spiritual exercises. And if you're not sponsoring people, where the hell do you think you are? Because Alcoholics Anonymous is about passing this on for fun and for free. And if you're not doing it, that's fine. But don't represent yourself as being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's what we do. Just a little opinion. When I was 90 days sober, I went and visited my grandmother, Alice. Alice had taught me how to tend bar. I just owed her a little money. I said, "Grandmother, I stole this money from you. Here's part of it back, and God and AA are helping me to stay sober." She said, "What'd you say?" I said, God and Alcoholics Anonymous are helping me to stay sober. She said, great, kid, bye. And she got her hat and purse and started moving for the door. Where are you going? She said, about 4 years ago, you and I had a conversation and you told me that you didn't believe in God anymore. So I went down to the church and I put your name on a list. And me and the girls have been praying for you. And I need to go down and report that my grandson has been restored. Spiritual terrorism. It works really, really, really well. Example. 1985, my then wife Jacqueline got sober. We picked three people. Her best childhood friend, my buddy Jeannie, who probably a lot of you know, that was a cocktail waitress and worked at a saloon that we worked in, and my sister Regina, who was missing in action with her self-employed entrepreneur Colombian boyfriend. Every meeting we went for, we prayed for those people. In a year and a half, all three of them got sober. All three of them took birthday cakes. And the two that got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous are still consecutively sober. And the woman who got sober in a treatment program decided that she'd really made too much of it. And she chose to drink. She chose to drink. You know, this program has afforded me so many wonderful opportunities. You know, I was unable to take care of myself. You know, the great thing that I've got to tell any of you is that since I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not gone to jail. I figured out the equation. J plus alcohol equals jail. I have not cried but three or four times out of self-pity, saying that I'm sorry. I weep for joy. And I've gotten to do all kinds of wonderful things. Has my life been all, you know, giggles? No. You know, I've had a marriage and lost a marriage, and I have a wonderful marriage now. I have a relationship that I wish for each of you. And she's a sober woman, and we share this thing. And, you know, I created businesses. When I was 15 years sober, I went and did an inventory, or 10 years sober, I went and did an inventory, you know, when were you happiest in your life, you know, follow your bliss. And for me, it was when I was selling stimulants to college students. So I started opening coffee bars on college campuses, and I had a wonderful run at 10 years of that, and it was grand. It was just grand. And now what I do is that I go around, I do work where we build additions to schools and hospitals and provide hospital equipment to folks down in Central America, because that's just kind of what the evolution of my life is. And the evolution of my life is far grander than any dream I ever had. And so I want to tell you a couple of stories about, you know, the whole thing about afflicting the comfortable is, you know, what are your dreams? What is it that you'd really like to do? You know, a woman tonight was talking about, well, I just started writing and all this stuff's opening up. One of the reasons you never want to do a third step is because you're afraid you're going to end up being a missionary in a third world country, right? I mean, because no hipster ever wants to do that. And I've had the opportunity to pray and meditate with a lot of different people, and I have a really good time doing it. And I've found the realm of the Spirit to be very open and inclusive. And I urge, I implore every one of you to try different stuff. But if people say to you, well, Alcoholics Anonymous is a lower form of understanding, spiritual understanding, just smile at them, shake their hands, and kind of move towards the door. Because they don't have to understand this. So anyway, I'm hanging out at this church one Sunday, and a guy gets up and he says, I'm going down to Central America, and I'm going to build a church, and who wants to go? And I'm sober like 15 years at the time, and I've been meditating for years, and I know to listen to my heart instead of my head. My head tells me I don't have the time, I don't have the money. So I say, okay, I'll go. I'm in. And I go home to my nice Jewish wife, and I say, I'm going to go down to Central America, Bill Asper, J-Dop! And I said, but I don't have the time, and I don't have the money. And she says, well, just talk to your customers. They'll send you for entertainment value. And they did. They all had the same prayer. Don't let him take any power tools. No power tools. And so I go down there, and I'm down with these nice people. I'm down there for about 3 days, and I regularly attend meetings. I go to 3-4 meetings a week, no matter what, that I don't gas bag at. And I'm down there, and I need an AA meeting. And so I look at this Guatemalan guy, this priest, Martir, and I say, Yo busco Alcoholics Anonymous. And he starts to cry. And he says, you just found it. You just found AA. I'm AA. And there in the middle of the jungle, this man told me his story. And I told him mine. And every time that I try to do something of a spiritual nature for God as I understand God, what happens is that I end up with you. I end up with Alcoholics Anonymous. That experience was so wonderful that a couple years later what I did was I got a bunch of my buddies because I knew that religion wasn't the deal. The deal was service. That's what you taught me. So a bunch of my buddies and I got together and we went down and built homes in Belize. And we helped shelter 150 kids. You know, why not? Why not? You know, just following what the next thing, the next simple thing is. And now I got together with a guy and we put together a nonprofit and we're taking like used medical equipment that can't be done in the United States and we're providing it to hospitals that have nothing. You know, and all I'm doing is I'm just following the thread. Following the thread. Another thing about the ninth step is that, you know, we try and sometimes we don't get the result we want. My father, you know, alcoholic male, father problems. Oh, really? Mother problems. Fascinating. Anyway, I tried to make amends to my dad when I had like 4 months sober, and he just got up and walked out of the room. And I tried again when I was 5 years sober, and again when I was 10. And we were never able to really, he was never able to be present long enough because he was a quarter pounder, you know, at least a quarter vodka a day. And then when my marriage dissolved, my first marriage, I sent him a letter. And I said, Dear Dad, I have now committed every sin that I ever judged you for. Please forgive my arrogance and my judgmentalness. And he was very verbose. He got the letter. He called me back, said, got it, thanks, bye, click. But a couple years later, I'm up and I'm hanging out with him and his spiritual advisor, bartender. And I said to him, he got up and left for a minute, and the bartender says, you know, your old man, he carries that letter in his wallet. In 1993, my stepmother gave me the privilege of helping her die from cirrhosis of the liver, which is a horrible, awful way to go. And she got to die at home. And the soundtrack to that was, you know, when you're drinking hard and you're throwing the glass, the ice at the bottom of the glass, and my dad is drinking and I'm in, you know, doing what needed to be done. And after she passed, my dad was really in a bad state. And everybody at the funeral is going, hey, what are you going to do about the old man? I ain't doing nothing. I ain't doing nothing. You want to talk to him, talk to him. But I gave him like 6 weeks. And 6 weeks after my stepmother died, I just happened to be driving by. He lives up on the Oregon border in Yreka. And I just drove up and drove in, and he's sitting there in his command post. You know how you got your command post, and he's there in his 6:30 in the evening in his bathrobe, covered in his own waste. And oh, hi, Dad, how are you? You know, but see, I've been on the 12-step calls. I've been working with others all the time that I've been here. And I didn't have to get all angry at him or get, you know, appalled at him. I knew how to get him in the shower and clean him up. And I said, tomorrow we'll take you to a place I found. We're going to detox you. You know, you don't have to go to the silly meetings. But I just want you to, you know, we'll just clean you up. And he gets up the next morning. He goes, well, I thought about it all night. I'm not going to go. Now, he's pretty bad shape. I can just hit him with something heavy, throw him in the trunk. But I did what you've taught me to do. I went and had a quad latte. And hard to discern the will of God when you're asleep. Anyway, I'm familiar with this book. And in Dr. Bob's Nightmare, it talks about if you think you can quit drinking liquor on your own, that's entirely your affair. And I walked back into the house. I said, okay, Pops, see you later, bye. And drove away, and there wasn't any emotion to it. And about a week later, he called me up and he said, you know, I'm about half angry with you. Really? Why is that? He'd kicked by himself. And my dad never had another drink. And, you know, physical sobriety is a wonderful thing. And he was able to, you know, reconnect with some of his mother and his daughter and me and some other folks. And last Easter, a year ago Easter, my sister was up there with him, and she said she was talking about her sponsor, and my dad said, well, what's a sponsor? And she explained it to him, and he said, well, I guess Jay is my sponsor. And it was the sweetest thing that he ever said to me. Anyway, he had a real fast-growing tumor, and I went up and I was with him, and we decided that we weren't going to do the hospital thing, and we went home. And it was funny, while I was up there, I went to a little AA meeting in Medford, Oregon, and they were having a little roundup, and one of my dearest friends, a woman by the name of Mildred Frank from Toronto, Canada, just happened to be speaking that Friday. You know, and I got to go and connect with my friend Mildred, and then, you know, got my sister there and my grandmother, and we helped my dad die. And my father died on the second day of May in 2004, which was the 25th anniversary of my coming to you, my 25th anniversary in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that finally just completely made me ridiculous about any way that I look at this world. You know, it broke me completely open. There's so much going on that I don't have any clue about, that I don't understand. But I do know that if I go to Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis, and if I pray and I meditate, that this life becomes something entirely different than what it was before I came to you. Just before this new year, I sat down and did what I do every year. I said, what would I do if I could do absolutely anything? Absolutely anything. And for me, a lot has happened in working the 11th step. And so I decided that I'd invite people to meditate. So I got together with one of my spiritual advisors, and we put together a website with a bunch of different meditative practices, all predicated on starting at 3 minutes. And we're doing it each day at noon. If you want to, you know, I'd like to invite you. I got the site in my pocket. But, you know, I'm inflicting spirituality on everyone. And then on the second day of May at 5 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time, we're inviting everybody that we can get together to do it at the same moment. Will that change anything? I don't know. But I don't live my life anymore predicated on results. I predicate it on doing things. Each and every one of you, there is a man or a woman whose life that you can save. Only you can save them. If you're available and ready to sponsor them, if you've done the work and you're here and you're asking this power that saved our life what to do. If you don't, who knows what happens? But what happens is that we have the opportunity to be there in the second holiest place on the planet. The holiest place is the birthing room. The second holiest is sitting at a table when a man or a woman thinks, okay, I'll do this. I'll give it a shot. You know, it's the most rewarding thing in the world, and God bless you, and I really hope you get after it. Thank you.